Thank you. Hello, everybody. We are approaching the countdown or the count up to a new year. And it is a time, as I've spoken, other people have spoken, I'm sure, of both trepidation and opportunity, joyous anticipation coupled with fear. That is kind of the combination of the month of Elul. But I, if you remember, I actually left you with a question at the end of last week that I want to continue on. Last week we were looking at the story of the Ephas Toar, of reclaiming the beautiful woman that is a captive in war. And according to the Arizal and the Zohar, this was a mashal to reclaiming our neshama, to getting in contact with the purity that is within ourselves, that is the real war, the war against the Yetzer Hara, that wants to claim our goodness and destroy our potential. So the question I had raised is that there are two types of wars that Halacha recognizes. Halacha recognizes obligatory wars, wars to eradicate Amalek, wars to defeat the seven nations of Canaan, and then it recognizes what are called optional wars, wars of expansion, which are not really optional, but have to have the permission of the Sanhedrin, which we don't have today, and the permission of the Urim V'Tumim, which is really direct prophetic authorization. And which war is the din of Yefas Toar talking about? Rashi says that Yefas Toar must be talking about the optional war, not the mandatory war, because in a mandatory war you must destroy the enemy. There will not be captives. When you wage war against Amalek, men, women, and children are killed. It is only in the optional war you could take a woman or a slave as a captive. Therefore, Rashi says, again based on the Sifri, Rashi didn't just make it up, that the whole parsha of Esha Shefas Toar is referring only to Milchemet Reshut and not Milchemet Mitzvah. So the question I left you with is this. If Esha Shefas Toar is a metaphor for the fight against our Yetzer Hara to reclaim our neshama, if we were to ask ourselves, is that an obligatory war or an optional war, we would certainly classify it as an obligatory war. There is no greater obligation in life than to wage this struggle. So why should the Torah introduce this metaphorical idea in a parsha that is not dealing with a war of obligation, but it's dealing with a war that is optional? If you want to fight it, you fight it. If you don't want to fight it, you don't want to fight it. That's certainly not the Milchemes HaYetzer. So here, there really is a very, very profound idea that one needs to internalize. And the idea is that although the war against the Yetzer Hara is certainly an obligatory war, tactically, you fight it like an optional war. You do not fight it like an obligatory war. Meaning the way you fight the Yetzer Hara is through the mechanisms that you utilize in a Milchemes Reshus, and not through the mechanisms that you utilize in a Milchemes Mitzvah. What do we mean? The primary halachic difference between an obligatory war and an optional war is in an obligatory war, the enemy is destroyed. Amalek, the seven nations, you obliterate the enemy. In an optional war, instead of having to destroy the enemy, you subjugate it, recapture, transform it. When a person looks at their lives, and a person wants to do tshuva, there are two different modalities that one can use in doing tshuva. One might be called the tshuva of amputation, and the other might be called the tshuva of sublimation or transformation. Amputation, let's say a person looks at 10, 20, 30, 40 years in which they weren't keeping the mitzvahs, they weren't doing Hashem's will, And now they've come, they've seen the light, now they want to change their lives. How do I connect to that past? How do I connect to my family? How do I connect to my friends? How do I connect to my past life? There are two ways of doing it. One is to make believe that past never existed. Obliterate. Become somebody new. You are a new person. What's past is past. We'll call that, and again this is borrowed from Rav Soloveitchik, this is called the tshuva of amputation. You simply look at part of your life as a gangrenous limb which you must get rid of because it will destroy you. Sometimes that is necessary. The same way there are times that a limb has to be amputated, there are times that a part of our life has to be amputated. But just as medically, amputation is a very last resort, so too spiritual amputation is a last resort. You know, when you, God forbid, someone amputates a limb, there can be a very severe phenomenon known as phantom pain, which can be very, very debilitating. Or to take a less serious example, but one that could be very bothersome as well, when you have to delete a complex computer program, no matter what you do, it's still floating around there. Indeed, that's how the government gets numerous criminals to try to delete all sorts of files. But something's always there. You can't really escape who you are. We are who we are. We are a product of our experiences. And if we simply make believe they didn't exist, it will come back to haunt us. So the higher madrega of tshuva, the deeper madrega of tshuva, is not simply you take your past and you cut it away, but you look at your very years of rebellion against God, or at least not knowing God. You look at those past experiences. You recapture them. You control them. You rule over them. They become the foundation of your strength. They become the source of your uniqueness. They become the specialness that you bring to Avodas Hashem. Do you see, what can I say, the genius of the Torah's insight? The ultimate, the Rebbeinu Shlomo is the ultimate genius, of course. And that is, yes, Yifas Tovar is about Melchames Mitzvah. But you don't fight it by obliterating the evil. You fight it by channeling it. So for example, let's say somebody had been a drug addict, for example. Now they're doing tshuva. So one way is to simply go to Kollel, you know, just deny that they ever had that life. I don't mean lie to people, but internally. Just deny they ever had that life. Forget it. And Kadima, just go forward. But the problem with that is, as wonderful as that is, it is basically saying, my first 20 years were a zero. My first 30 years were a waste. They were nothing. My life started at age 31. That might be so. But 30 years is just a zero. But let's say, as a result of a person's experiences, he's able to be a drug counselor. He's able to counsel people. He's able to understand the situations people are at. Now that's a very different situation, because there he is not simply rejecting his past. His past becomes the strength of the uniqueness of what he can contribute in a way that wouldn't have existed had he not been through that difficulty. This is really the explanation of a very enigmatic statement in the Gemara. The Gemara says, Reish Lakish says, when a person does tshuva out of love, not only does Hashem erase the sins, but Hashem converts the sins into mitzvahs. If you have a billion sins, you do tshuva out of love, you now have, erasure just means you're down to zero, which is still good. I'd rather be at zero than be negative billion. But a zero is just a zero. But no, tshuva out of love converts the deficit into a positive. The Berdichever of Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev once went up to the town Russia, and he said, I'm so jealous of you. All you need is 1 second of tshuva, you'll be a much bigger tzaddik than me, because you have so many averos. They'll all be converted. Wow. Tremendous. But this is very enigmatic. I understand, although that's also a miracle, that God forgives, God erases. Even that is a great miracle. But I can understand erasing, I can understand forgiveness. But how can I understand? I get credit for my averos? I get credit, I'm going to get reward because I was a drug addict for 25 years? The answer is, yes. Not because you were a drug addict, but the concept would be, if I use even my averos as the basis of my strength, then Hashem retroactively says, I'm going to consider that part of your chinuch, that was part of your training, that was part of your on-the-job preparation for who you are. Which means, miraculously, tshuva does not only change our futures. Tshuva redefines the meaning of our past. It puts our past in a new perspective. What is the saying in the National Archives? I think there's a saying, the past is prologue. And I have to admit, growing up, I had no idea what that meant, but what it basically means is that the past is not just the past is the introduction to your life. And that includes even to a life of averus and the like. And that is why the Milchemes HaYetzer is not by amputating and destroying the enemy. It is by capturing the enemy and using it to serve Hashem. Now this is an important lesson not only for drug addicts and the like, but the truth is this is true for many of us. You know, people come from different types of paths. I mean, I certainly am with Talmidim, the vast majority of which came from non-religious homes. And the question becomes, you know, when you want to meld in, you want to be part of the Haredi world, you want to be part of the religious world, there's a great natural temptation. Kind of deny your past. And again, I'm not referring to lying, I'm just referring to kind of a psychological distancing. That's not me, I have no connection. Cut off connections sometimes with parents. People ask all sorts of shailas, you know, can I allow my children to see my parents because they only use Rabbanut Hashgacha or something? That's a little bit of an exaggeration. You know, they rely on that, but usually it's something more serious and the like. Now, I will say this, you know, the MS is, you know, the Chazon Ish himself said, we should be much more concerned about exposing our children to people with bad midos than with people who are lax in ritual observance. Because the MS is, if a child understands Shabbos and Kashrus, the child understands. And the parents are not deliberately trying to sabotage things. They just don't know. So a child knows. I've seen 5-year-old children. No, they won't take, they won't, in fact, there's a whole story. There were a bunch of fights. There were a bunch of fights and offered a child a candy. And the candy looked at Abba to see, can I take it, you know? Because, you know. So kids learn that. A kid is not going to be, if a child understands Shabbos and Kashrus, they're not going to be a Mechal Shabbos or Kashrus because they have a relative who doesn't keep Shabbos. You explain to them that there are people in the world who haven't learned yet, we love them and they're wonderful people. But the Chazon Ish says, when it comes to midos, bad midos are contagious. That is very true. If people are angry, people are upset, people are cruel, people insult, that children do pick up. And the Chazon Ish says we sometimes ask the wrong question. People are so concerned about exposing our children to children who are not 100% from, when the real issue should be the midos tavos, the meidadam l'chavera, because one is much more contagious than the other. And one has to be aware of this. So people want to cut up their relationship to their families. People sometimes deny the talents that they have. A person might have a certain talent in music or literature, and they feel it's treif, it's not the right thing to do. Now again, of course, halacha has boundaries, and one has to know. You might not be able to do exactly the same things. You know, if a woman was a great singer, you know, whatever it is, to a mixed group, you know, it wouldn't be shaykh to do that. There are going to be, sacrifices that a person makes in avodas Hashem, in which the gain is much greater than the sacrifice. But generally speaking, a process of tshuva that causes you to deny your essence and deny the significance of your formative experiences, by definition, is going to have a lot of phantom pain. in which you're not really going to be able to get away with it. And therefore, milchemes tshuva has to be fought like a milchemes rishus and not a milchemes mitzvah. And you know, people have to remember this. You know, you sometimes look, and we look at, you know, Baruch Hashem in Yerushalayim, you can look at tzaddikim and tzidkaniyos, you know, that may go back 100 generations or more of kedusha. And here, you know, I might be from South Dakota or whatever it is, or Missouri, whatever it is. And I think to myself, if only I came from 100 generations of Kedusha, I could be an Eved Hashem. I could be righteous. I could be holy. I could be good. But Nebuch, what am I? But you have to know, every person has to know, whatever the background is, that if the tzaddikim that live in Me'ah Sharim, that go back 100 generations, have many things that we don't have. Yes. But it's equally true that the person from Missouri or South Dakota has things that the other person doesn't have either. It was ultimately HaKadosh Baruch Hu that decided where our neshamas would be born. It was HaKadosh Baruch Hu that decided what experiences we would have. Again, it's coupled with Bechira, but certainly the experiences we had as children were not a result of our Bechira in any way. And if HaKadosh Baruch Hu put us into experiences which on a superficial level seem to be against Yiddishkeit and against Torah, one has to see that in a deeper level, it was part of the Hashkacha that this was a journey that would perfect our neshamas and bring out the uniqueness within our neshama that literally could not have been brought out in any other scenario. Again, it's something to think about, that the person from South Dakota, I don't know why I keep on mentioning South Dakota, but bring something to the table, bring something to the matzah, bring something to Klal Yisrael, bring something unique to Kavod Shemayim that otherwise wouldn't exist. And although I recognize the tremendous pressures for conformity that exist really in all religious communities, but one has to kind of at least preserve, if nowhere else, but at least internally. Sometimes what you do on the outside, you know, got to be careful sometimes. That's to be sure. But at least internally, one does not lose a connection to what you are and what you became. And one should take a non-arrogant pride that accomplishment. And that is what is called recapturing the enemy as opposed to obliterating the enemy. Because obliterating the enemy is never going to be successful. But capturing the enemy is hard. But that's something that's doable. I mentioned the story before, I'll mention it again, I apologize for the repeat, that I knew a fellow who grew up in Virginia, and he was from a totally secular environment. And he came to Eretz Yisrael after college just to a trip, you know. This was pre-birthright, but it was equivalent to a birthright type trip. And somehow, as happened to so many people, he became not only religious, but he took an extra step. He became a Ger Chassid. Now, this is quite unusual, because Ger is not in the outreach business directly. And what is even stranger is he actually met a young woman from Europe who became a Ger Chassida, which is even more unusual, a Balas Tshuva. And they were getting married in Me'ah Sharim. So I was invited to the wedding. I knew him from his older days. And, you know, I had black hat, black suit, but I was not tremendously comfortable. It was not a most natural environment for me. Everybody was speaking Yiddish. By the way, the men and the women were separated by different buildings, not just, the women were 2 blocks away in a different building. So his parents were there. His parents are now deceased. His parents were there. And if I felt a little uncomfortable, a little unnatural, the parents thought they were in the equivalent of the Twilight Zone. It really was very, very bizarre. And they're looking around. Their eyes are wide open like, you know, like they don't know what they're looking at in any way. But at the end of this event, they waited. They brought the kala back, so they had to wait like 20 minutes to bring her to the from that other building. But they bring the kala back for Shevar Brachos, and he was going to give a drasha in Yiddish. Amazingly enough, he picked up Yiddish, but before he spoke in English for a few minutes, and he wanted to thank his parents. He says, "Mom and Dad, I know that the life that I'm living is not the life you expected. And I know that I'm doing things very, very different." But he said that 90% of what I am does come from you. You know, whatever honesty I have, whatever midos I have, you know, he said, comes from you. And he said, the 10% that does not come from you is because you gave me the strength to find my own way in life. So, it was a very, very beautiful statement. Now, I remember I was sitting next to a guy. Now, it could be maybe he was also a hidden American, but yeah, it seemed to me the guy didn't know English at all, but he was nodding away. This is an example of Dvarim Hayotzim and Alev. Things that come from the heart enter the heart. So he was saying, good, 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 very good. He knew that something good was being said here. And something good was being said, because it really is. I probably say this story all the time, so you may have heard it 10 times, but it's worthwhile to repeat. Because it really means that a life of Torah should not be a life of division, a life of dissension, a life of rejection, a life of polarization. A life of Torah should be a life of love and a life of connection. Now, is that going to be true all the time? No. Again, sometimes you have to amputate an arm. Yeah, I understand. So sometimes there have to be amputations. I understand. But that's the last resort. That's not the first resort. That's when everything else fails. I mean, listen, even in Hilchos Kibud Av Yom, forget about religious, non-religious. Sometimes a person can have totally religious parents, and you have to distance yourself if there's a toxicity in a relationship. And Halacha recognizes that although a child can never be disrespectful, you can never be rude, but there are times in which, you know, you can't talk. I understand that. But those are tragedies. Those are not Kirov strategies. In other words, they're not like the way I teach a person to be from is by cutting yourself off. Rather, in a tragic situation, those things have to be done. But optimally, the true Kiddush Hashem that comes into the world is when you have that type of connection. And that is called capturing the enemy within, as opposed to obliterating and denying the enemy within. And that's really a tremendous idea of how we look at our past and how we understand that our past mistakes are actually the springboard. Our mistakes and our experiences are the springboard out of the greatness that we can achieve. It's not that we achieve greatness despite the setbacks, but the setbacks are the foundation of the greatness that we achieve. So, Baruch Hashem, this actually ties into a thought in yesterday's parsha as well, so we can move into that. You know, we have the mitzvah of Bikurim, the mitzvah of the first fruits. Now, in case you wonder, the mitzvah of Bikurim, unlike Truma and Maaser that we still separate today, Bikurim we do not do today, because Bikurim are one of the halachos that very much depend on a Beis HaMikdash. When there's no Beis HaMikdash, there are no Bikurim. That's just the halach, and even Drabanan. So we don't do it today. But a farmer would see, by the way, the translation first fruits is not quite accurate, because Bikurim are from the Shiva Haminim, that includes chitos orech, wheat and barley as well. Right, the farmer goes into the field, typically between Pesach and Shavuos. He sees the first ripening of the grains or the fruits, and he ties a little string around them so he'll know. And he takes these to Yerushalayim, and there's a ceremony. He puts it in baskets. The basket is placed before the mizbeach, the altar. It's not a korban, though. It'll be given to Kohanim to eat. And they eat it outside of the mikdash. But it's put in front of the altar. And then there is a five-pasuk recitation, which is an encapsulation of the history of the Jewish people. How Yaakov went to Mitzrayim and we became enslaved. And Hashem redeemed us. And Hashem brought us to the land that He promised to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And here are the fruits of the land that Hashem gave me. And I am expressing my gratitude to Hashem. If those psukim look familiar, you of course will remember that they are the foundation of the Haggadah Shel Pesach, beginning with the words Arami Oved Avi. And there are two translations to this. The way the Haggadah translates it, and Rashi follows the Haggadah, Arami is Lavan. Lavan, the Syrian, from Aram, Oved Avi, wanted to destroy my father. Like Lavan wanted to destroy us. So according to Rashi and the Haggadah, Arami is the subject of the sentence, Oved is the verb, and Avi is the object. Right? He wanted to destroy my father. The Ibn Ezra actually has a very totally different translation. Arami Oved Avi means, my father was a wandering person originally from Aram, meaning, because that's where the Avos came from, meaning Yaakov is the wandering Aramean who was wandering from place to place. But whatever the translation is, this is a brief encapsulation of the history of the Jewish people up to that point, and it's really giving a reason why we bring Bikurim. Because of gratitude to Hashem who redeemed us from slavery and gave us the bracha verse. By the way, you'll notice in the Haggadah we don't say that last verse. Consistent with the idea that we don't have a fifth cup that Hashem brought us to Eretz Yisrael, because although Baruch Hashem we're here, but we don't have the final Geula yet. So you'll notice too, out of the five verses, we only say four of them in the Haggadah, because the fifth verse is Vayivienu Elamakom Hazeh. So it's very consistent. The same omission of the fifth cup is why the fifth verse of Mikra Bikurim is eliminated. Okay. The Mishnah describes a very beautiful ceremony. Remember, Bikurim were not brought in one day. In other words, in fact, it's a common mistake. People always say, oh, Shavuos is the day you bring Bikurim. Shavuos is the beginning of the period of Bikurim. People brought Bikurim the whole summer, and you can bring Bikurim between Shavuos and Sukkot, and Bidiyeved all the way to Hanukkah. So Shavuos was not the day that everybody brought Bikurim. It was just the beginning of that period. In fact, according to Halacha, Bikurim were actually not brought on Shavuos. The earliest day of Bikurim is the day after Shavuos. As Shavuos itself is the earliest, but you don't bring it on Yom Tov proper. Okay. So it describes that every single day, people from different towns were coming. That people would assemble in, from different towns. Everybody from Tel Aviv would come and bring their Bikurim, or whatever it would be. And it mentions that all the artisans, the blacksmiths and the tailors, people who would be working, shoemakers, when the town would walk by, they would stand up and honor them, and they would say, Anshe so-and-so city, Anshe b'nei Brak, Boachem l'shalom, welcome, welcome to the holy city of Yerushalayim. In fact, it's interesting that Rav Soloveitchik says a very interesting idea. You know, there is a minhag that many people have. Although it's a pretty new minhag. In fact, some old-timers don't consider this a valid minhag. That we stand up, if you're sitting down at a chuppah, so when the chassan and the kala walk down, people stand up. Now, that's actually a fairly new minhag. In Europe, that was not the minhag, maybe because nobody was sitting down. There were no chairs. It could be. There were just no chairs. But there was no special minhag in Europe that you stood up for the chassan and the kala. But in recent years already maybe 30, 30, 40 years, it's been relatively common, although you'll still see older Rosh Yeshiva do not stand up. I mean, whatever. You ask most people, why do we stand up for a chassan and a kala? So most people will give you the answer, chassan domel lemelech, the chassan is like a king. But there's a kasha on that. The chassan is not a king until he's coronated, till he marries. He's walking down the chuppah. He's not a chassan yet. He's right. So if anything, we should be standing up when he comes back. Of course, people are already up. But technically, there's no chassan ben melamelech. He hasn't been coronated yet. So Rav Soloveitchik says the following. He said, it's very interesting chiddush. He says, the makor of standing for a chassan, now we'll see if this explains kala, is the idea that when people came to bring their bikurim, they were honored by the workers standing up. And why is that so? Because when somebody is going to do a mitzvah that you're not involved in yourself, you stand up to honor him. You honor people that are going to do a mitzvah. So, the Rambam says, marriage, even it's not just Puravu, having children is a mitzvah, but even without Puravu, the Rambam says, Kiddushin, marriage, is one of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. Ki yikach ish isha. It's a mitzvah. The chassan is going to perform a mitzvah. We stand up to honor him because he's performing the mitzvah. Now, that's an interesting point because it's not so clear that the kala has the mitzvah of getting married, because the mitzvah of getting married is in the Torah ki yikach ish. It is referring to what the man does. An interesting question if the kala would be considered to be fulfilling a mitzvah of getting married. We know that a woman, by the way, is not obligated in having children. Strange, strange mitzvah. The man has an obligation to have children, not the woman. Okay, man, go ahead and do it. Yeah. Obviously, it's not going to work. But again, the Meshech Chachma says a swara. I think we mentioned it months ago. The Meshech Chachma says a swara that since pregnancy and childbirth are potentially, Baruch Hashem, in most cases not, but they are potentially life-threatening conditions, the Torah could not obligate a woman to put herself in danger. The Torah obligates a man to find a marriage partner who is willing to take this on, but the Torah cannot make it a chiyuv for the woman in that way. But not only is a woman not chayiv technically in pru or vu, but she's not chayiv in the mitzvah of kedushin, meaning from the perspective of pure halacha, not hashkafa certainly, from the pure halacha, a single man is doing something wrong if he is able to get married. A single woman technically has more of the option halachically because she does not have the mitzvah to get married, nor does she have an obligation to have children. But hashkafically, obviously, Hashem wants men and women to be married, and that's what we try to accomplish. Okay. All right. So this is the ceremony of Bikurim, a very beautiful ceremony. Now, the Mishnah then goes on and mentions the following strange thing. Rich people would bring their Bikurim in baskets of gold and silver, and they would hand them to the Kohen, who would then hold the basket as the Psukim were recited. Then the Kohen would take the Bikurim and give the basket back to the rich guy. I mean, I take the fruit, you keep the basket. Poor people who couldn't afford it, they brought their Bikurim in wicker baskets, and they were too embarrassed to ask for it back. You know, just like, you know, if you're entitled to a 10 agurot of change and you didn't get it, you know, you're not gonna say, you know, hey, you forgot the change. So they didn't really ask for the baskets back. And the Gemara Bava Kamma says, we see from here the old saying that the poor get poorer. If you're poor, you get poorer. You know, if you're so poor, you don't have a good basket, you lose the basket too. Okay. So this is what the Mishnah says. The commentary Taisus Yom Tov was written by Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, who was the Rav of Prague. He was a Talmud of the Maral. He was the successor of the Maral in Prague, and a Talmud of the Maral. And he lived in the 1500s. For some reason, buried in Krakow, I believe. He became Rav in Krakow after was it after the Chesmar Prague? Okay, well. Okay, I'll have to check the back issue. I know the Kevers in Prague. I saw it in Prague. I'm sorry, I was the Kevers in Krakow. I know that. Yeah. But Teshuvah, one of the great Mefarshim, asks a kasha, and that is, the Gemara in Moed Katan tells us that originally, when people would die, families would spend a lot of money on funerals. In other words, there'd be fancy coffins. There was no halacha. Everybody was buried the same. They'd have begadim and jewels and gold and silver, etc., and they would bury it with the person, like tombs and the like. But what? Huh? Not originally. But what happened was that poor people were so humiliated they couldn't afford this. That sometimes, that sometimes they would literally abandon the dead body, so they wouldn't, you know, just, they would just leave the body in the street, so the city, the kehila would take care of it. So Rabban Gamliel, who was the Nasi was not only the most influential leader, the richest, the greatest gadol, he left a tzava that when he'd be buried in a simple wooden coffin, and the white tachrichim, which was the garment of the most poor, the poor of the poor. And since then, it became a minhag Yisrael, which is now a halacha, that everybody gets buried the same way. I mean, men and women have different types of tachrichim, but, and the reason is, shelo levayesh esmi she'ein lo, not to embarrass people who don't have. We don't want to make distinctions in a public mitzvah, like halvaya sameh. Now, lemaisa, the truth of the matter is, Brooklyn Eretz Yisrael is a little better, but in the United States, actually, funerals are quite, with all of the simple cloth and everything else, funerals are quite expensive. You could very easily, even for a so-called simple kosher funeral, could very easily be $10,000 or more. So it's not so simple to even die in America today. But the idea of the halacha is we don't want to embarrass people. In fact, it even said, huh?
You still have to pay.
That's correct.
It's an extra charge.
It is an extra charge. That's right. Now, what's interesting is that there was even a minhag that you might find very, very strange. they used to expose the face of the mace. Like, why is the face of the mace covered up? Yeah, because the following. Poor people who died of starvation. It was a humiliation to their families to see the emaciated face. So that's why they were masakin, and the face is covered. They used to be the equivalent of a wake. People would come and look at the body. Chazal were masakin because of the people who died of illnesses or were disfigured or emaciation. Everything's covered up, so there shouldn't be any type of busha. Yeah. Rabban Gamliel, he was one of the nasi. Did you hear the story? This is also reported about the Reichman family in Toronto. Very, very charitable family, Balei Tzedaka. So one of the Reichman brothers died a few years ago, and he left two letters, one to be opened right after his patira, one to be opened after Shiva. And the one right after his patira was he instructed his children to task the Chevra Kadisha that when he's buried, he should be put in the kever with black socks that he liked, his Shabbos socks. Okay, the children didn't understand it, but they went to the Chevra Kadisha. They said, our father requested that he buried in these socks. The Chevra Kadisha said, no, we don't make any exceptions. Everybody's buried the same. And they were really arguing, our father was a Yerei Shemayim and a Tzaddik and a Baal Tzedaka. He must have had his reasons. Can't you make a little exception? He said, no, we don't make any exceptions. So they were heartbroken. They couldn't carry out their father's last request. Anyway, they sit Shiva. After Shiva, they open up the second letter. And the second letter says, I assume by now that you asked the Chevra Kadisha. I know they said no. I know that I'm buried without the socks, and I knew that would be the case. The reason why I gave you that request in the first place, knowing it would be denied, is I want you to know that, you see, no matter how much money you have, no matter how many billions of dollars, you can't even take a pair of socks with you when you leave this world. So remember why Hashem gave you money. It's nothing you're going to take with you. The only thing you can do with it is tzedakah, masim tovim, and the like. You take nothing with you. You could be a billionaire. You don't take a pair of socks with you in the next world. Yeah.
It's interesting that you said that a wake used to be part of...
Yes.
Because I had the experience, I was working among 50 goyim, I was the only Orthodox Jewish, and somebody in my office's mother passed away, and the office was going to the wake.
Yes.
And I liked this woman. I had a relationship with her. I didn't know what to do if I was even allowed to. So I called the guy who was going to take me in his corporate to take me in his car. And I said, listen, I have to call my rabbi. And he's going to ask me questions that I'm not going to be able to answer about a week.
Right.
So I called my Hasidish Rav Muncie. And he asked questions, and this guy was answering. He asked me if he was going to be in a church. No, it was going to be in a funeral parlor.
Right.
And he asked if there was going to be religious ceremonial things around, and the guy said no. And Ralph gave me permission to go. And then the guy looks at me and he says, in 2 minutes, you got a hold of your rabbi. And if I want to get hold of my priest, I have to wait days until we meet. I can't believe that you had to.
Well. So some rabbis take days too, so I don't want to. I don't want to make a generalization, but okay. Including me sometimes, yeah.
How does Hiddur Mitzvah for the
Lulav
and
Esrog
come in? Why don't they?
And what about
this? Yeah, it's a good question. So let me finish this up, but it is a good question. No, the question is, for Lulav and Esrog, people have very expensive Lulavs and Esrog, a Hiddur Mitzvah, it's called beautifying the Mitzvah. So the question is, why aren't we concerned about discrimination of rich and poor? But one answer I'll give you is that, and that is, it's not so recognizable. Meaning, if you looked at super duper best esrog and cheap esrog, the difference is not immediately striking. It's not like gold and silver versus wicker. It's harder to know. In other words, really only an expert. Sometimes, in fact, what you think is the more beautiful. Now, if you show a person two esrogim, which is the more halachically beautiful one, people might pick the wrong one. So I would think it esluv and esrog really doesn't make the same. Now, maybe a silver talus, that might be a distinction. Okay, so there was a funeral home, and one more little joke, and I'm going to go back to the main point. This is a true story. A funeral home in New York around 3 years ago was trying to market expensive, fancy coffins to Jews. And they said, I know that other funeral directors will tell you that the Jewish way is a simple coffin. But this was an innovation, this was a reform, this was not the authentic Jewish practice. The authentic Jewish practice was to have a fancy coffin. Now, this is a true advertisement, actually, because yes, before Rabban Gamliel, that was the minhag. In other words, a reform from the time of Rabban Gamliel, hazaken. But okay. So now, the Taisus Yom Tov's kasha is this. If we are so concerned for not embarrassing people based on wealth in a public mitzvah, then we should have made a takana by Bikurim that everybody brings in a wicker basket, not to embarrass the people who can't afford it. For example, you remember on the 15th of Av, which was the day that women went out and people would choose their shiduchim, so it says specifically that all the women wore borrowed plain white garments, not to discriminate or embarrass between those who could afford and those who could not afford. By the way, that is actually one of the arguments. There are a lot of arguments why girls' schools have uniforms. Some of it is mitam tznias, and some of it is also to minimize rivalries and jealousy of fashions and the like, rich and poor, so everybody dresses the same. Right? In men's yeshiva, they all dress the same anyway. You don't have to have any particular dress code for that. So the Taisus Yom Tov says, why don't we do the same thing for Bikurim? So his answer is, he gives an answer, his teretz is that since Bikurim is a ceremony that is occurring in the Beis HaMikdash, so when it comes to glorifying the Beis HaMikdash, that's so important that we don't really care who gets embarrassed. You have to glorify it in the greatest way that you can, and therefore that overrides the concern of not being Mavaish. But there are Sfarim that give a deeper answer to this. And they say the following. The Mishnah in Brachos tells us, the last Mishnah in Brachos, a very famous Mishnah, Chayav Adam Levarech Al Hara'ah Kederech Shumavarech Al HaTova. A person must make a bracha for the bad the same way you make a bracha for the good. The Gemara explains, this does not mean you make the same bracha. Rachman Al Islan, for bereavements, we make the bracha Dayan HaEmes. For good things, we either make the bracha Shachiyanu or Atova HaMeitiv. But what it means is, the Gemara says, that no matter what happens to you, and no matter what type of bracha you have to recite, you accept it with serenity. You accept it with simcha. Now here you have to understand what simcha means. Accepting adversity with simcha doesn't mean you jump around and dance on the table. Oh, I'm so happy that this tragedy happened to me. You know, that's not realistic. And keep in mind that unlike Buddhism, for example, that teaches that suffering is an illusion, it's imaginary, Judaism very much recognizes that suffering is real. That's why we have Hilchos Avelos. We're supposed to grieve. We're supposed to mourn. But there's a simultaneous process. It's a little difficult to explain. Where side by side with sadness and grieving and mourning is an inner sense that whatever Hashem does in the world is going to be good. That there's meaning, that there's purpose, that there's not abandonment, that although I'm in a dark tunnel, I know Hashem is holding my hand and walking me through this tunnel with me side by side. The simultaneity of grief and joy, maybe joy it would not be the word we would use in English to describe it, but kind of an inner serenity. You see from an interesting phenomenon, and that is, you know, Chazal say, Ruach HaKodesh or Nevuah cannot be on a person, cannot rest on a person, unless they're besimcha. So here we have an obvious kasha. There are so many Nevuahs of the Nevi'im that are about Chorban. The book of Eicha, book of Chorban. Now, because this is Kisvei HaKodesh, it must have come through Nevuah. So, was Yirmiyahu happy when he's writing about the Chorban? The answer is, on one level he was. Overcome with grief, there was the simcha of being connected to Hashem, side by side. So, that's the idea of simcha. Tzorich lekablinu besimcha. Alright, how do we know this? So the Gemara quotes a pasuk, V'samachta b'chol hatov, Asher Hashem Elokecha Nosein Lach. you shall rejoice, v'samachta, in all of the good that Hashem Elokecha has given you. So what is the drash? Hashem is Yudke Vavke. That is Hashem's name of mercy. Elokim, Elokecha, Elokim is the five-letter name of Hashem. That is the Midas Hadin. So what is the pasuk saying? You shall have simcha, knowing that everything Hashem gives is good, whether it's coming from the Midas HaRachamim or whether it's coming from the Midas Hadin. So the whole makor, the whole source of Chayav Adam Levarech Al Hara Kederech Shem Levarech Al HaTova is from the pasuk V'samachta B'chal HaTayv Asher Hashem Elokecha Nisein Lach. Where is that pasuk? That pasuk is the last pasuk of the Parsha of Bikurim. We read it yesterday. So is it not odd that Bikurim, which is a ceremony that is so filled with joy and accomplishment, that's where the Torah teaches me, accept the bad along with the good? I would understand this lesson. After Aaron's children died, the Torah could have said it there, no matter what happens. Mechiras Yosef. But at a point of total simcha? The answer is that in a very, very, very subtle way, in a very gentle way, Bikurim is about bereavement as well. Bikurim is about bereavement as well. What do I mean? The Gemara says, Adam writes, a very famous Maimer Chazal, Adam writes, Bekav Shalo, Yaiser Mitisha Kavin Shal Chaver, a person prefers a very small measure of grain that he worked on himself than many, many more things he gets from others. A person has a special love and affection for that which he created. In fact, the love of a parent towards a child is connected to that idea that we had so much involvement in making this child who he is. So think about a farmer who worked so hard. Again, some of you that are gardeners may have a little bit of a sense of this, and of course with Shemitah you're going to have a whole revisiting about how to do that. Maybe that's a share for another time, obviously. But you work and you plow and you plant, and you look at the weather and you're worried so much, and finally you see after so many months and so much physical effort and so much investment of money as well, you see the first ripening of the fruit. How precious that is to you. How much you love it. How much you cherish it. And God, in effect, takes it away. God says, give it away. So what does Bikurim teach? Of course, it's in the context of joy, but what is Bikurim teaching me? Sometimes Hashem takes from me that which I thought I loved the most. But I give it willingly, and I give it with love, and I give it with joy. And therefore Bikurim, in a very gentle way, I'm not going to compare it to the Akedah, but Bikurim, in a sense, is a mini Akedas Yitzchak, where a person understands that surrendering myself to God sometimes means I give up that which is most precious to me. And on that, the Torah says, you shall rejoice in all the good that God gives you, whether it's a Midas HaRachamim or a Midas HaDin. So now, let's go back to the Taisus Yom Tov. Taisus Yom Tov's kasha is, why do we put poor people in an embarrassing position? We should make a uniform takana so nobody knows who's rich and who's poor. But if Bikurim is about seeing the blessing in your life, no matter how difficult it might be, then fakert, the poor person, has nothing to be embarrassed about. Your life is your life. Your life is a blessing. Your life matters. The very fact, if we were, in other words, think about it this way, if we were to say, oh, we want to cover up the fact that you're poor, that would be saying, what you are is no good. What you have is no good. We got to make believe you're somebody else. But Bikurim is about seeing the bracha V'samachta b'chol ha'tayv. The rich person who has a lot of money has a great, great bracha, but there are many nisyonos. There are nisyonos in being wealthy. A person gets arrogant, a person gets stingy, a person gets selfish, a person is too preoccupied with his business to think about other people, their Torah and mitzvah. There's a bracha, there's a nisayon. The poor person has the bracha of perhaps being in a matzav where b'teva he's going to be more humble, but of course he has the difficulties of living that life. Each one has its challenges. Each one has its blessings. Bikurim is about recognizing the value of your life. Again, it ties into the Mochemes Rishus that we talked about. You don't got to pretend. The rich guy doesn't have to pretend to be poor. And the poor guy doesn't have to pretend to be rich. You have a simcha in the life that Hashem gave you. And that is why we don't cover anything up. Now, it's interesting though, in spite of this, there is one thing in Bikurim where we are concerned with embarrassment. And this is very fascinating. The Mishnah says, originally, when people would bring the Bikurim and they would read these psukim, if you knew how to read, you would read them yourself. If you didn't know how to read, the Kohen would read it for you. The Chachamim were concerned with not embarrassing the people who didn't know how to read. So they became a uniform takana. The Kohen reads for everybody. Here's the point. If you're poor, there's nothing to be ashamed of. If you're illiterate, yeah, that's something to be ashamed of. But look at the genius here. We're not embarrassing the illiterate person. Pumperkert. In order not to embarrass him, we have the Kohen read to everybody. But what is that communicating to the person? I guess this is something to be a little ashamed of. In other words, this is a brilliant educational strategy. You don't teach by humiliating somebody, but by communicating that this is such an important value that somebody should feel a little bad if they don't know how to learn, don't know how to read. You're in Eretz Yisrael, you're in Yerushalayim, you're surrounded by Chachamim. Go and learn! What's stopping you? You see? So we're not embarrassing the person, but we're making him realize this is something that needs to be taken seriously. It reminds me of a little maisa with Rav Steinman. Very cute maisa. He really was playing straight man here. It really was kind of a classic story. A man in Bnei Brak who was a successful businessman felt he needed to buy a very expensive new car because he had to deal with his clients and they needed someone who lives at a certain style. But he was afraid of Ayin Hara. He was afraid that people would be jealous, Ayin Hara. So he goes to Rav Steinman and he says, you know, I'm just afraid. I have to do this for business, but I'm afraid of the Ayin Hara and jealousy. So Steinman looked at him and said, have you finished Shas? He says, no, I haven't. He says, do you learn Torah every day? He says, well, not every day. So Steinman says, I really don't understand your question. He says, you haven't learned Shas, you don't learn every day, why would people be jealous? He says, what would people be jealous of exactly? In terms of, you know, and listen, Steinman knew exactly what the guy meant, but he was communicating a certain musser there. And that's the idea. Now, I just want to end with a maisa from Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, which is a beautiful maisa, but I have a kasha on it, but it's a beautiful maisa. There was a man in Brisk who was a very, very phenomenally wealthy person, at least by the Eastern European standards. And he was a tremendous balstucker. He was totally generous, and he did it with anivus and yiras shemayim, without arrogance. He was a shomer mitzvahs. He learned Torah whenever he could. He really was a tzaddik and someone who used all of his money l'shem shemayim. And what happened was, at some point in his life, he was reduced to absolutely abject poverty, a poverty in which he had no roof over his head. He was living in the street. He didn't complain, but Rav Chaim's own sons, the Brisker Rav and Moshe Soloveitchik, they didn't understand. They went to Rav Chaim and said, listen, I understand the ways of Ribbono Shel Olam are beyond us, but can you give us some explanation? Here was a person who used every single kopek that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave him, and he used it in the right way, without arrogance and with emunah and with gratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How could this happen to him? Why would this happen to him? Why would he be left without nothing? in the street, without a roof, without a shack. And Rav Chaim said, in the secular world, sometimes people go to school for many, many years to learn a certain talent. Right? You go to medical school, you learn to be a doctor, and then after you master the profession, you're able to then work at it, and the like. And it takes many, many years. But sometimes a person then has a change of profession. I know myself, when I taught law, I had students who were former doctors. Probably they were sued for malpractice and they wanted to see the other side. They go to law school. And then you have to start from the beginning, because if you want to be mashlim yourself in a different mikzoa, you need different courses, different training, different chinuch. Rav Chaim said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us a life that is our educational mission, to learn how to live with certain circumstances. This was a person who was given the task of learning to live with Ashiris. And he mastered that koach. He mastered it totally. He graduated. So Hashem said, now that you've mastered how to live this way, I want you to master how to live that way. Because your neshama is so precious that I want to give you the full opportunity to be an Oved Hashem in all of these matzavim. And therefore it was a sign of Hashem's love for this person that he wanted him to have a shlemus in every single aspect of Avodas Hashem. So again, it's a perspective to think about as we go through things. But anyway, I want to wish everyone again a kesiva chesima taiva, and we should use the rest of Elo in true cheshbon hanefesh and be zeicher to a good year.